Wesley Hogan is director of Duke Center for Documentary Studies. Her new book is called On the Freedom Side, How Five Decades of Youth Activists Have Remixed American History. And she joins me in the studio now. Wesley, welcome back. Good to have you here.
It's good to be here, Frank. Thanks.
I want to talk a little bit about some of Bob's critique, and it is shared by many, many others, so we can talk about them even more generally. But let's talk about your book and sort of how it came about, because you recognized at a certain point that historians and, our classrooms may not be doing a good enough job in telling the story of activism in America, particularly youth activism.
Yeah, this book came to be in 2006-07, and the Genesics, young men involved in a school yard fight, black and white students, and the black students were charged with second-degree aggravated assault, and the young white people were given detention. And so on the campus where I was then teaching, Virginia State in Petersburg, Virginia, about 300 students gathered and marched up and down College Avenue trying to bring the question of equity to the forefront. And, you know, this question continues to resonate throughout our school systems. Just yesterday we saw that video out of Orlando with Kaya Roll, and so we continue to face these questions of equity in the school system. But at the time, these 300 young students were, some of them were in my U.S. History Since 1865 class, and so they came to me and said, no one cares about what we think. We were just 300 college students marching up and down. We didn't have media. No one paid attention to us. You say young people changed the world in the 1960s. That's not true anymore. And so I was driving literally up 95 later that day, thinking as a young professor, I had completely failed these young people. And what went through my mind was all of the examples of history that we haven't shared with them in K-12 textbooks, whether it was the fourth grade Virginia history textbook, which doesn't mention Barbara Johns, who was a 16-year-old who led young people in the 1950s to out of their school. 100% of students left the school to try to protest the lack of equal facilities for young black students, or whether it was 17-year-old Carmelita Torres in 1917, who was a domestic who lived in Juarez and worked every day in El Paso. And she protested every day getting deloused at the border and shuttered that racist policy. So there were all these examples I was streaming in my brain thinking, how come these young people have never learned about it and they don't have a sense of their own power? And so over the next decade, just began to track what had happened since 1960 with youth activism and started looking at youth groups in the 1990s. And then, of course, in 2013, the movement for Black Lives emerged. And that really forced me to determine a new storyline or to think about what kind of new storylines might be possible that we share not only with college students, but with very young people, fourth and fifth graders.
You know, it seems there are two, though, separate threads here, though they seem entwined. On the one hand, there's a sense by people, 300 of your students got active. They
right.
did something. So they were going to go out there and do it in the absence of any knowledge or mm-hmm. sense that anyone had ever done this before or even succeeded. So
right.
on the one hand, maybe we don't need to know. On the other hand, they came back crestfallen that nobody seemed to care. Mm-hmm. This might have an impact on whether they'll do it again tomorrow, right? So talk about, these are the two threads. On the one hand, there is an impulse and an impetus right. among young people to get out there and do something, would you say? Or have you found that or not?
Absolutely. I mean, I think young people take us at our word when they recite the Pledge of Allegiance and when they hear the national anthem at ball games. And then they bring forward things, whether it's in their homes or in their schools or on their jobs as high school students, what's wrong with the society as they find it. And they ask us, you know, can we have a democratic debate about what we're going to have for dinner? And what does mom say? Or, you know, they ask a high school principal, can we publish this editorial in our school newspaper? And they hear again and again, sort of no, be quiet, follow the rules. And so I think what has really inspired me is, especially since 2000, the immigrant rights young people have been driving forward a conversation about who belongs, who counts as an American. What do we do in the face of the Dreamers pushing forward legislation in 2001 that both Republicans and Democrats agreed to in spirit, right? The initial legislation was bipartisan. It failed in 2001, it failed again in 2007, it failed in 2010, and they stayed at it, trying to make sure that there was a pathway to citizenship. So I think it's that spirit of making sure the country lives up to its mission statement that has most impressed me and has most capacity for changing the way our future looks. Because I think at this moment, the other thing that's new, and this speaks a little bit to Bob's statement, we are facing apocalyptic futures. And that's really different if you're 30 years old than if you're Mitch McConnell's age. And so this is, people are bringing forward new solutions, and it doesn't necessarily resonate with people who are 50 and older. And I think it's really an important thing to facilitate some intergenerational conversation, because the ideas that young people bring forward, we kind of tend to accept if they're musicians or they invent new technologies or they're sports figures. But when they're political innovators, we tend to have a really tough time even seeing them.
Well, the other thing that Bob and other critics are pointing to is the cacophony of voices, often voices tearing at each other, that the interest groups and the grievances become so refined that one tears against the other, whereas we're both might be seen on the same side of the spectrum were they to work together. And it may disturb an older audience, but then that older audience, people my age, forget how messy the civil rights, you refer to Ella Baker. It was an exceptionally messy movement with a lot of arguments and a lot of fist fights that went into it, and a lot of good came out of it.
Yeah, I think for sure all movements are protective of those kinds of mess. You know, people don't tend to want to air their dirty laundry. They want to provide a unified front. So as historians, part of our job is to get in there and remember the messiness of it. But to speak to the broader question that Bob raised, I think if it's okay, I want to back up for just a second. It's perhaps understandable to see freedom movements as causing the alt-right, but it's bad history. And so I think that the challenges in terms of what causes what, the same underlying cause leads to both the backlash votes on the one hand and the freedom movements on the other. In one case, people see themselves as victims and they're susceptible to us, them thinking, and they tend to be that one third of the population that Bob identified as part of backlash politics. And then there's the other response when you are backed into a corner, is that people step outside a victim and become agents of their own destiny. And so that is really exciting. That's the freedom movement. That is these young people with these great new ideas. But in both cases, the underlying cause is an immensely hierarchical system, as you guys both referenced in your earlier conversation, that sort of turns people into numbers and turns people into, or makes them feel dehumanized, whether it's in schools or on the job or on the highway, or just when we're trying to get clean drinking water. And so I just want to emphasize that those movements themselves are not the cause of the backlash. It's really those larger systems which dehumanize people that cause it.
This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. I've been talking about youth-led activist movements with Wesley Hogan. Her new book is called On the Freedom Side, How 5 Decades of Youth Activists Have Remixed American History. And now we have one of those activists in our studio now doing some boots-on-the-ground work. Deatra Jackson is in Durham. She's a Durham-based social activist, the national director of the Black Youth Project 100, also called BYP 100. Dee Dee, welcome back. Good to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's get an example. We'll talk about some of the things you're doing. We've talked about some of the larger movements, but right here in Durham, you've been active in Durham Beyond Policing, creating that coalition, participatory budgeting in Durham. Talk about some of the things you're involved in.
Yeah, so in 2016, we had caught wind, a few of the activists and organizers here in Durham, that the police were going to be building a new headquarters in the city, and it was going to cost us $81 million. And a few of us that were already organizing, Black women, women of color that were organizing along with Southerners on New Ground, decided to come together to make sure that, firstly, folks knew about this. This wasn't a project that was widely known across the city. And we also wanted to make sure that we were pushing for a narrative where the city was moving beyond policing, beyond criminalization of our city, and that the funds would be reinvested into community efforts. And so we did, went out and talked to people, talked to the residents, and we're like, very simply, if you had $81 million to spend on your city, what would it be? And no one mentioned a police headquarters. People mentioned doing something about the homelessness in the city, more access to food, more healthy food options. People mentioned more after-school programs, things for kids and teenagers to do. And so we built this campaign during Beyond Policing. It launched in March of 2016, and it's still going. Within the first 6 months of the campaign, one of our major demands was to increase the minimum wage in the city and push for city workers to receive $15 an hour. And working with UE150, which is the local city workers union here, we were able to win that. And so it kind of launched a great surge of momentum around what was possible, what's possible if you build with multiple organizations that are moving in multiple ways, but believe that there shouldn't be this much money that's given to the police.
So give me a sense of how that works. Who's doing the organizing? You talked about going and talking to people. Mm-hmm. Who's doing the talking? Who are the organizers? Who are the members of your group with the clipboards? Mm-hmm. And who are you talking to? And are they looking like you? Are they the same age? What are those conversations like?
Yeah, it's variations of people. It's mostly Black women that's leading a lot of the organizing that's happening in the city in general, but specifically around Durham Beyond Policing. But there was also young women of color, folk friends, people that had been organizing to get rid of HB2 in the city, or have been pushing for just a more democratized city, a more progressive city. And so we would go to the bus stations and talk to people. We would walk around downtown and talk to people. We would knock on doors just to collect a real sense of where folks are. Do folks know about this $81 million police headquarters? And also, what would you imagine for the city if you had this money?
See, what's interesting about this is that you're talking about people who may be initially organized around a particular interest or a particular identity. And this is one of the critiques that I will hear from among my aged peers, is that this kind of identity politics is destroying the left. But what you just said is so instructive. Mm-hmm. Perhaps you got started that way, but ultimately what you found when you started talking to people is what they more generally and more broadly we're interested in: a living wage, a fair wage, dealing with some of the chronic social issues in our city that were well beyond the scope of your initial identity and your initial organization.
Right. And also talking to local businesses. Mm-hmm. We got a chance to go to businesses and ask for their approval of, like, where do you, like, do you believe that the city should actually not be spending this much money on policing, very simply. And we received a lot of really good feedback, and folks wanted to be on board. So it was a combination of folks that are already attached to organizations and just regular Durham folks that are concerned about where the city is going.
So as you started out, you said we started out as an organization of Black women and other organizations, maybe it's around individual identities. Were there then conversations at some point, hey, this isn't our fight, why don't we stick with the stuff? We've got our own problems. Did that, because we know, and Wesley, I think, will back me up on this, those are the kind of conversations going on in the 60s around movements and whether or not coalitions could be built. And I'm wondering if they're happening today.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're moving, and the folks that I organize with, and in BYP 100, we move with a very radical Black feminist practice. And a Black feminist practice in organizing looks like coalition buildings. It looks like collaboration. It looks like working with not just folks that already know what they're talking about, but finding the folks that want to find us and bringing them into the fold.
What got you involved in this work?
So I was living in Miami in 2012, 2013. So during the time that Dream Defenders was being built and that Trayvon Martin was murdered, and I was in grad school at FIU and was watching things on Twitter and on Instagram, but had no idea how to get involved. And I attended a Black Student Union meeting just because I had nothing else to do. And there was two people from Dream Defenders that were at that meeting, and they spoke about Dream Defenders, the work that they were doing, them going on marches and organizing for folks to go to Tallahassee to speak at the Capitol, and immediately got involved, started doing organizing on my campus, building the campus chapter of Dream Defenders, and doing some local work in Miami around policing, police brutality. And then also, I was wrongfully arrested while I was in Florida, became a survivor of police brutality, which only added a match to a smolder that was already there in me. So I've been committed ever since. I've been politicized in the South. I'm from Philly, but all of my politicization has come in the South with a Southern context.
Wes, I want to ask you just a question as a historian, because I find what you're saying, Didi, so fascinating, because we know, you know, sort of historically, if we can go back to the 1930s, even the labor movement in this country is something I think people don't quite recognize. But what we would have called the labor movement in the 1930s was very much interested in these kinds of questions: social justice, equity, who owns what, and how do we buy in, and what's the hierarchy here? It all changed after World War II for a variety of reasons, and we won't get into it. But there was a time when people saw themselves as part of much larger coalitions, although they may have been organized as a labor union or as some other kind of organization. Those coalitions were much broader then. And I'm wondering, first of all, if that gloss sounds even remotely accurate, but if it does, are we seeing maybe a return to that? Is there some hope in that history, that perhaps there is something like that reviving in this country?
Yeah, so I'll just start with Didi's story. I mean, I think the sharing of what happened in Florida and then work back to the 1930s. The work of Rick Scott, the governor of Florida, when Trayvon Martin's killer was acquitted, as a dethroned healthcare executive who had been a venture capitalist as sort of his entry to political life, he publicly refused to call a special session after the Dream Defenders occupied the Tallahassee State House. They were asking people to overturn the Stand Your Ground law, which had protected Trayvon Martin's killer, and put forward instead a sort of three laws that they called Trayvon's Law. And those laws, if they had been passed, would have protected all young people in Florida's public schools from criminalization, allowed them better access to the education that they needed. And instead of even putting that forward, he asked for a day of prayer. And in the state legislature, only 42 lawmakers of the 96 necessary voted in favor of holding the special session. 90 voted against the session. 28 didn't participate. So you see this sort of widespread ignorance and refusal to act on this very basic need, which harkens back to the 1930s. We want quality education. We want safe housing. We want a good job. We want safe communities. And so I think it's really important. It's not that I'm in particular saying that young people don't make mistakes. We all make mistakes. I think it's just that their mistakes are likely to be inconsequential compared to the known consequences of staying the course. We know if we stay the course with Stand Your Ground in Florida that there are going to be more young people like Trayvon Martin killed, and that's unacceptable. And so it's been really inspiring to see the way that when people like Didi and others, whether it's Durham or Tallahassee, act on specific grievances, other people come around and support them to create this better world for everybody.
And Didi, you've talked about, among other things, getting groups together around the idea of healing justice. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so in our organization, so BYP 100 is a national organization of Black 18 to 35-year-old movement builders, activists, artists, organizers, and we exist in 10 different cities. And so there's 10 at least different cultures that exist within our organization. And in 2014, 2015, when we were really forming and solidifying who we are as an organization, we recognized that in order for us to really be committed to this work, we have to be committed to each other. And we have to develop practices of how do we want to be with each other. And so healing justice and transformative justice really became one of the centerpieces for the organization. How do we actually deal when there's issues of hurt, harm, abuse, and conflict that happens just within the organization? Mm. And even with us being an abolitionist organization, we're a police and prison abolitionist organization, I mean, as much as we can be. And so that meant that we needed new behaviors. We needed to develop new systems in the organization of practicing how do we deal with each other, even when there are instances of hurt, harm, abuse, and conflict that will happen. And we've developed a kind of internal, I call it an internal like ambulance for the organization. Mm-hmm. And these are all members, and it's volunteer based, but it's our healing and safety. We call it HSC3. Our healing and safety community care core, and they help in developing preventative practices and measures for practicing healing justice within the organization.
And I wonder about in that case, just listening to what you're saying now and talking about these broad-based coalitions with some very, very specific goals and ideals, how you hold that together. You used the phrase, as we were deciding who we were going to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, that suggests a kind of very definite identity. How do you manage that kind of definite identity over and against, or perhaps beyond, the other principles that have to obtain about openness, being dynamic and open to new possibilities?
Yeah, it's ever-changing, yeah. And it varies based on who we're working with, how we're working with them. I mean, I think there's practices that we have within the organization that we try to spread, such as radical consent. We have a radical consent curriculum within the organization of how do we make consent a way of every interaction that you have, you want it to be with full consent. And so we try to bring those things into our organizing, into the strategies that we hold, and also into the coalitions that we build for a more just practicing of collaboration and kind of bleeding that feminist practice into everything.
And getting back to some of the critiques that we've heard about fractiousness, tearing apart the left, I know you just got back from South Carolina, and you were counter-protesting a march that presidential candidate Pete Buttigieg was taking part in. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. So there was a group of us from many different states, but BYP 100 members, and we came with from a call to action from Dream Defenders for Black activists from across the country to come to South Carolina and talk to voters. And we did a ton of door knocking in Charleston and Columbia, and we were in Charleston and were excited to attend the strike and march in Raleigh that was held by the Fight for 15 folks, organizers.
Yeah.
And BYP 100, we've been a part of the Fight for 15 stuff since it started. Like, even the shirts that we were wearing, I'm young, I'm Black, and I want a 15 in a union, were from, like, 2014. So we were excited to kind of re-engage in that and be with the workers. And many of the workers were from North Carolina, so those are folks that we've also marched with here in Durham. And we're marching, and next thing, we stop, and there's about 3 to 4 Black SUVs that hop out, and 20 cameras, and Pete Buttigieg, while we're marching, comes and just stands in front of the march, in the middle of the banner. It just was such a visceral co-optation that was happening in front of our eyes. And we couldn't, like, it just was... We just couldn't.
But why? But, I mean, here's a guy who's maybe poised to actually put this into action in a place where you're not quite there yet. So rah-rah, Pete.
Huh? Yeah. I mean, I think actions speak louder than words. And that's what we were trying to convey of, like, the chant that we were saying was, Pete can't be our president. Where was 15 in South Bend?
Right. I mean, that was the point, was the hypocrisy in this.
Because there isn't, city workers in South Bend are not making $15 an hour, and folks from South Bend have spoken very, very truly about why he should not be leading this country, very simply.
Well, I want to thank you both for being on the program. Wish we had much more time, but I'm talking to Dee Dee Jackson, National Director of Black Youth Project 100 and a Durham-based social activist. Wesley Hogan is Director of Duke Center for Documentary Studies, the author of On the Freedom Side, How 5 Decades of Youth Activists Have Remixed American History. Dee Dee and Wesley are going to hold a talk tonight at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, 7 o'clock, and we've got that at our website if you missed it, stateofthings.org. You can find out anything else you want about the show at the same website. Thank you both for being on the program, by the way. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
State of Things is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Holler-Mormon, and Katie Barron. Jenny Lawson's our technical director. Josie Tarr is our intern. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.